Dun, 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 dun. We are live, and hello, audience.
Hello, hello.
Oh, I was wondering if you were going to chime in or not.
I decided to add a little voice here.
A little voice. Maybe a big voice.
No, I'll leave it to you.
Ah, okay. Very good. Well, welcome to today's episode. Thanks for tuning in. As always, if you want to support the show, you can write us a review, recommend us to your friends, or check out our Facebook page, or ask us to do an episode about a certain topic. Welcome to Spies and Lies, an espionage podcast, co-hosted by me, Omri Rose, who spent his childhood living undercover, thanks to his dear old dad and co-host, Jason, a retired former spy master of one of the top intelligence agencies in the world. Without further ado, let's dive into today's episode. The Arabelle Network. Very mysterious, the Arabelle Network.
Well, it should be very interesting. If you listen to the first two episodes, then you'll understand what we're talking about.
But you don't need to. This is a standalone episode.
It is. Okay.
Julius Caesar once said, "I am too great a man to die by an enemy on a field of battle. No. My death, if it shall come, will be from shadows. Remember that, dear Brutus, for it is sometimes our own shadows we must fear most. And our trust must be carefully placed, which is why I keep such good men about me. And you, Brutus, a man such as you must know, trust, trust is all."
It's really good, that Shakespeare, didn't he? Right? Well, he wrote well.
That wasn't Shakespeare. That was Julius Caesar. It's quoted as him saying that.
Really?
I have it on a good authority from some very trustworthy sources that I looked up, that I have contacts with, that that is a quote directly from Julius Caesar. How ironic and interesting that he was saying this about trust to Brutus, isn't it?
It is.
It is. And it leads right into what we're talking about. Because if you haven't guessed by now, I made up that quote.
You
did? It's completely fake. It's not real. What is the value of making up information?
Depends on the aim you want to achieve in the end.
It does indeed. As we will find with the Arabelle Network, this is a network that actually never existed.
It did exist in one side's eyes and belief, and that was the beauty of the network.
It's a network that existed in one man's mind and was then expanded to a whole organization's mind, and they believed that the Arabelle Network existed. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. For those of you who did not listen to the two Juan Pujol episodes that we had just released, don't worry. You can still listen to this episode and enjoy it. We will give you the background. For those of you who have listened to those previous two episodes, this will expand your knowledge on the amazing life and success of Juan Pujol. So, what is the Arabelle Network? Well, if you haven't guessed by now, it was created and run by Juan Pujol, a Spaniard, Catalonian, technically, codenamed Alaric, who served as a secret agent for the Abwehr during World War II. However, he was actually a double agent who eventually would work for the UK. And the Arabelle Network itself? Well, that was all a scam, a fake. Juan Pujol made it all up. For the British, he was codenamed Garbo, after the actress Greta Garbo, in honor of Juan Pujol being what British intelligence called the best actor in the world. Initially, Juan Pujol set up his network while he was operating in Portugal, but pretending to be in the UK. He used British travel guides, newsreels, and train timetables, plus his own incredible imagination, to build the first of the Arabelle Network's informants and agents. Eventually, by the end of the war, there would be 27 agents providing constant information to the Germans, mostly completely fabricated information, but the true things that were told were designed specifically to either arrive too late or not be of actual military use. As I said, we cover two whole episodes on Juan Pujol's amazing life, which are available now, but you can follow along without listening. Today, we will break down the agents that Pujol created along with British intelligence, and specifically with the help of Officer Thomas Tommy Harris of the MI5. We'll also cover the function of the different agents and how they all worked together, analyzing what other agents might have been created and how someone might go about creating a network, fake or otherwise, today.
Yes, it is very interesting because you see the diversity and the genius of the work that was done, and how they actually created such a vast network that made sense, basically, of why the information, how come he has all this information. And that was the brilliance of the whole idea.
As far as the Germans were concerned, it was a real network. And after the war and up until about, you know, the 70s or the 80s, before the truth kind of came out, they would have looked at the Arabelle network as a really effective, strong network in their history records. It was convincing, and if it was real, it would have been a very strong network.
It was real.
To them.
To them. You asked me in one of the episodes why they didn't find out about it and what could have done to solve it. We will talk about it as well, a little bit about it in this episode. I think it would be interesting to think together why this happened.
Well, we must begin at the beginning with the first agent recruited by Juan Pujol, who was a KLM steward. Juan Pujol was in Lisbon at the time, pretending to be in the UK, and he had to find a way for his letters to be postmarked from Lisbon, because, of course, he couldn't send letters to the Abwehr address that he was given that would be stamped and letterheaded and everything from the UK, because he wasn't there, so he couldn't do it. So how could he do it? So he came up with this brilliant idea of creating a fake KLM steward who would take his letters and post them directly from Lisbon when he flew in.
Now, if you think about it, that was brilliant. He solved two things in one flow, you could say. One, he made it clear why the letters were not coming from England. And two, it allowed him to explain how he's getting it over and how it can't be always on the same or the right time. And maybe why it's easier for maybe even to get the letters to
a
certain address.
A human touch, a human element to it, a third party, which would add complications, as you said, that if it didn't arrive on time or something messed up, there was also this level of defense that he could use of this other person that could have been involved.
I thought it was interesting as well. I mean, you're going to probably mention it, that he even gave an explanation that he left the letters open so the guy can read it.
Yes.
And well, then you could say, well, then he wasn't recruited, was he?
Right. Well, it was also a thing that he was saying that the agent wasn't at first so keen on doing this, going to send
and
letters.
And he didn't really know what it was all about. And it was very, you could say, letters that had no real meaning. That means that there was no information in there that was important.
Right.
But if he was an agent, why would he do it?
It was a great cover story. Basically, you know, he claimed that the KLM steward was not feeling comfortable. So he said, don't worry, the letters are going to be open. You can read them, which he could. And in the letters themselves, what was visible was a whole bunch of nonsense, basically travel stories, because what was really in there for the Germans was written in invisible ink between the lines.
So basically what he's saying is that the agent was not recruited. As a spy, he just
not as a spy, but so as he a could useful always say, idiot, as they say.
So he was. He used him, you could say, in a way where he cannot be said. The Germans can't say, "Okay, who's the agent?" They could ask him, but they didn't, because he never gave a name, as far as we know.
This particular agent, we don't have a name for. You know, also it could be said that sometimes when there's not names given, it's for protecting certain
exactly.
assets and agents. I will also say that another thing that he said was this would help avoid British censors who at the time were reading mail that was leaving the UK to make sure that no secret information was being passed. So it's another bird that he's killing with this stone. It's three stones, three birds, one stone. It's a lot of birds in one stone.
What bird was it?
A sparrow.
Wasn't a pigeon? Because
no,
usually you use pigeons.
No. Oh, okay. It was a swallow.
A swallow?
Yes. An African or European one.
Exactly.
Exactly.
But if you look at it again, here he says the guy really is not aware of the clandestine activity that he's doing. He's using him as an innocent bystander.
A useful
bystander
idiot.
that is doing it, that is helping him out. That is what he's saying at this stage in the
yes.
beginning, that this guy has nothing, doesn't know anything about
not
it.
Not part of the organization, but
he's just
helping
using
me
him,
do
he's
this
helping
thing.
Him doing it, paying him maybe some money to do it.
Exactly.
But he is not part of the network.
Precisely.
Different from others.
Right, right. His next sub-agents were spread across the country, spreading his reach far and wide throughout the UK, and the reach would only grow and grow and grow as the network grew. We're going to break down all the agents in a moment, just giving a kind of a bigger overview. When the agents were created and they were sending their information, in order to add credibility, oftentimes the agent's life was reported on, their character, their ideology, and their personality. Other times, sometimes certain agents would have hardly any information, or they would go dark for a certain time to, again, add to the authenticity of the lives that these people were leading. It wasn't that every agent was always available and always giving information. Some people gave more, some people gave less. Some people would go dark. Some people would have useful information sometimes, then they wouldn't.
There was, you could say there's two major times here. One, when he was operating by himself from Portugal. And the second time, obviously, when he was in the UK working with the MI5.
Yes, exactly. Because in the beginning, Juan Pujol was acting sort of independently, but technically working for the Germans. And he was in Portugal, as we said, pretending to be in the UK. And only later, after he was able to get in touch with British intelligence and was brought over to the UK, was he able to really expand the operation.
When he worked in the MI5, it was a completely different outlook about things.
A level of organization.
Not only the organization, but it was a completely different thinking, a strategy behind it.
Check out those two episodes if you want to have the full story. In 1943, so already after he's 2 years working, the communication was switched from letters sent to designated addresses in Portugal to radio communication. The Germans wanted it. So what did Pujol and the Arabel network do? Well, of course, they created an agent who happened to be a radio mechanic and operator who could help them. And this just goes to show the genius of creating and inventing is whenever something was needed, they could invent that they had a solution for it.
All across the information that was passed on, you see that in the beginning they were trying to find information that could be interesting. And then they were inventing people and situations to serve a bigger cause or serve a bigger picture. It wasn't just to feed information to show that he is worthy or that it's worthwhile understanding what he has to say, but actually trying to get from them information by using his network to get to understand better what they are looking for and what they need or what they already have. And that was a very genius side of a genius plan of theirs.
The most important function that the agents served was in creating a deception that would help in the D-Day landings, the invasion of Europe by the Allied forces. The D-Day landings were to take place in Normandy, but part of Arabel Network's mission was to convince the Germans that it was actually going to take place in Calais. And so, all of Arabel's network, all of its agents, would give tiny bits of information here and there, all fitted together like this big house of cards into a massive tower that could just as easily collapse if something went wrong. But all of this tower was pointing in the direction of Calais and spelling out that the invasion was going to be there. And in fact, it worked. Eventually, the Germans were so convinced, partially by Pujol and partially by other activities, that they left behind thousands and thousands of troops in Calais that didn't assist in German defenses in Normandy. A huge, huge, huge win for the Arabel network. The Germans were so grateful that they even called the network Arabel to begin with, which, loosely translated from Latin, means answered prayers. The Germans paying about $340,000 over the course of the war to support the network and agents. And that's money then, which means a ton of money now. Another story for the name is that Pujol named it after his wife, Arathili, and the word bell for beauty. So Arabel. So there you go. Now, Pujol didn't fully elaborate on his agents. And what we do know comes from little snippets that he disclosed in interviews later in life and in a biography that he wrote, and also from Thomas Harris, who documented in his work Summary of the Garbo Case, 1941 through 1945, listing and describing certain of the agents' activities as if they were real people and with their collaboration history for the organization.
Very important what you just mentioned about recording everything, because you have to be precise, and you have to have a continuity, and you have to have or believe that there's someone on the other side who is looking,
fact-checking.
You could say checking and understanding and trying to get to understand better who you have. And if you start making mistakes with names or places or birth or languages, or then the whole pyramid can fall down. So it was important and interesting that actually he documented each one of these people, what they did, what they said about them, and create real people and build on it. Because if you look at it from the point of view of from the German side or from the British side, one person can't have all this information. So what do? You say, okay, one person can have all this information if he gets it from other people. Therefore, One person is sending all this information, but they have to have someone feeding him. So every time they decided they needed something and information from a certain part, if it's what's going in the Navy, what's going in the ships, what's going in the Air Force, what's going overseas, what's happening in the home defense, how could he know about it? The other question was, do you know about it or you recruit someone? If you recruit someone, how do you recruit him? Where is he coming from? I think we will discuss it in a moment. Who are the people he recruited and what are their main ethnic backgrounds? So let's start about it, Omri.
Right. So there are a couple interesting images that you can see if you Google the Arabelle Network or Juan Pujol, and you see, and basically it's his name and then underneath it the different kind of networks and agents. So there were seven main branches, you could call them, and under each branch or sub-cell, let's call them, there was like a head usually, and then they're kind of people that fell underneath them. So the only outliers are in this first branch, which we'll cover first, and then all the rest will make more sense. Because it's kind of like the main person and then the people that kind of filter through them. So deputy chiefs and those kind of things. So agent number one was the KLM steward that we mentioned. And he worked for the Arabelle Network until 1943. So basically until they switched over to radio, then his services were no longer needed. Now, at the same time, they created another character, a KLM pilot who was also a courier. This is Agent 1-1. And he started working in July 15th, 1941. So pretty early on, very easy to assume that one person currying the things back and forth, not enough. Let's create a second identity of another person that would help send the letters so that we can speed up the information.
Exactly. Because there was so much information, it didn't make sense. Only one was doing it. And if someone was sick or not available, how did the information come? Now, what I found interesting here, and maybe I'm wrong here because I don't have all the information, is that—
Neither do I.
I hope so. I hope not. Or I hope that you do have some information, even if it's negative one. There was never a name.
On this person?
On these people, never a name. Because these people were the most vulnerable. Why? They were not in the UK. There were people that if the Germans wanted to, they could try and look them up and look for them. Now, how could the Germans maybe found out more or stop it? If they wanted to know more, they should have said, okay, what's the name of the guy? Now, you could say, okay, he could have protected by a code or didn't want to give his name. But it was never mentioned. Now, if they had some thoughts or worries, they could have then checked the flights and then start to see through the names, maybe, if they had the chance, the names of the pilots, or the names of the people that flew over, and then get a pattern who it could be, and then maybe try and speak to him and query it. They never did that.
The genius of Juan Pujol is that he created an atmosphere of trust for his upper handlers.
Like Brutus.
Yeah, like Brutus and trust. The trust is the most important.
Yes.
Initially, when Juan Pujol approached the Germans, it was after having tried to approach and failing to get in touch with the British intelligence. He tried three times, supposedly, and failed each time. And so when he approached the Germans to spy for them with the intent of becoming a double agent, he created this persona, so he was already making things up, of this fascist Spaniard who was super pro Nazism, and he wooed his handler. And so once the handler believed in him, then obviously he would believe in what he was selling, right? So if he sold him that the KLM steward and the KLM pilot were trustworthy, they wouldn't need to verify
as long as the information was true and coming in. They never doubted it,
right,
as far as we understand. They never questioned it. And that is something we should always learn as well in our work, that
trust but verify.
You always have to verify.
Agent 1-2, so this is still under the first heading, was another aviator friend. So we can assume this is another person transferring mail and helping facilitate that aspect of it.
And as far as we understand, they were not recruited as agents, just as couriers.
No.
So there was they would know really that there's a bigger picture behind it, as far as we understand.
Correct. We do not.
They did not give any information. They were just couriers, as far as we understand.
Couriers,
they were not,
as far as we understand.
Okay.
And they weren't even necessarily connected to one another.
Yes.
Which is what leads me to the next three, actually, which were a little bit strange to me, is why they're often categorized in this same branch of the one designation. So 1-3, 1-4, and 1-5 all hold government posts. 1-3 was the head of the Catalan Ministry of Interior section. He was recruited in May 16th, 1942. 1-4 is the Censor Ministry of Interior, April 4th, 1943 recruited. And 1-5 was the Secretary of Ministry of War, September 4th, 1943. So these are all people who I've bunched them together because presumably they would have been maybe connected somehow. But I don't see how they have any connection to the KLM pilots.
And the last three were recruited when he was already in England.
Yes. As contacts back in Spain. Catalan Ministry maybe, of Interior, Censor Ministry of Interior, Secretary of Ministry of War.
The only reason I can think now offhand is that they're related to the Spanish connection of Spain.
Yeah.
And related to that part of the world.
Yeah.
And so, not connected to specifically to UK intelligence.
Right. So that would be just contacts that would help corroborate maybe things coming from the UK from a different source. I mean, I'm saying maybe they're in Spain, but again, it's not written actually what Ministry of Interior it is. Is it for the Spanish Ministry of Interior? Is it for the British Ministry? Head of Catalan Ministry of Interior? That could be Spain. It could also be a division in the UK, potentially.
I would look at it in a different way. What kind of information would they received that made it interesting for the Germans to hear? Because that's why would he invent them?
So well, you have to look Secretary at the Ministry of War, we can understand why.
Yes.
War related things. The only thing that I would think of for the Ministry of the Interior is the head and the censor, just about activities of movements between things, maybe. I don't know. Confirming and corroborating ship movements, potentially, because a lot of.
I would like to bring a different idea here. I would like to say that if I'm like running a person like that, you have to look, one, what the message you want to send to the Germans. Two, you want to see what it is really possible for him to recruit. What kind of people is he able to recruit? And if you notice, and we'll see as we go along with this podcast, most of the people that he recruited had Spanish connections or spoke Spanish or were involved in something Spanish.
And also were driven by ideology primarily, aside from these KLM guys.
So it makes sense that he would offer to have even, I would say, people that are not specifically with full of intelligence, could be dramatic intelligence, but just to show that he is working and doing things
connected
to strengthen his ability that he's able to have a network.
For sure.
Not necessarily that this is the best information available, but to show that he is able to move around and get acquaintance and get to know people. And I think that was the message more than anything else.
Yeah, I agree. And also, again, I think it would be more about confirming information that maybe some of his other agents were sending through. That, like, if one of his better positioned people in the UK heard about troop movements, then he could maybe confirm it with the Spanish Ministry of War, let's say something else.
Do we have names for these people?
No.
No. So these are people who he kept vague with the names.
Well, another reason, because if they're not in England and they're in Spain, it's a lot easier for the Germans to find.
Or it's more, this is real people in real positions that you can check. So you don't want them to be able to check about it. And not having names, I would put them in the same bracket as the pilots. They gave information, but not necessarily agents.
Okay, so yeah, maybe that's why they're all in category one. These are all
people who gave him information. But not necessarily, or
helpful
helped.
Idiots, let's call
them. No. Helpful, they're never idiots. Helpful, but not necessarily were recruited in an intelligence point of view. The others gave actual real information.
Right.
Okay, therefore he gave them names.
Sure. So yeah, maybe these people are all people that Pujol is claiming he was friends with or had connections with. And, I spoke to my friend who
is X. Yes, and from time to time he tells me information about this and this. That's why I know something.
But they're not working for.
Exactly.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. That would definitely categorize all of them in the same one category.
Yes.
Then of not actual operatives. This brings us to the next category, unless there's something else you want to say.
No. I'm interested to see what the next category is going to be.
I love the next one. It's a really interesting one.
Okay.
Agent number two, William Gerbers, Swiss-German
businessman. Now we have a name.
Yes.
Now we have a name.
A Swiss-German businessman in England, and he was directly involved with shipping. Now, he was created by Juan Pujol while he was still in Portugal. The first three, Agent 1, Agent 2, and Agent 3, were created while he was in Portugal still.
And, of course, shipping and ships were always interesting because that was the way in and out of, you could say, into UK or into Europe. And as we remember from the last episode, the information about movements of ships was what really made a big balance on both sides towards him.
Additionally, one of the books that he had access to in Lisbon was about the British Navy. So that also maybe gave him the idea of creating a character related to that. A business person, which gives it enough distance that maybe he made some mistakes about the British Navy because he's not an expert. Swiss German, so also distance but proximity. Of course, the Germans can go, oh, well, he's one of us, partially one of us. That's why he might be interested ideologically. Swiss, semi-neutral, wealthy, just a good character that could be believable to be there and doing those kinds of things.
And he gave a name. That means you can give him a bit of more history. And
Gerber's, which is a very...
And it means you can task him and ask him more direct questions.
Yes. So he was reporting on troop movements. And initially, when Pujol was making up troop movements, because he had no access to it, he actually got lucky once and came pretty close to identifying real troop movements. Ship movements that supposedly William Gerber's provided. And that's one of the reasons why he initially...
And that triggered the MI5 to really look hard for the guy.
And also why the Germans really bought into the whole stuff, that it was good information.
Yes.
Now, later during the war, when good old William Gerber's was supposed to know information because of where he was, but that information that he was supposed to know would have been very negative to the British war efforts, what did Pujol and Harris do?
He got sick, the poor boy.
Exactly. They came up with a plan. Uh-oh, our agent here is supposed to know something and would report on it, but we don't want him to. So what do? They come up with an excuse that he's fallen ill. So ill, in fact, that he later dies from his illness, and they publish a fake announcement in a newspaper with details about asking not to send flowers and all this kind of stuff. It fooled the Germans so well that they eventually sent money for his widow, which they claimed existed.
Brilliant.
Brilliant, as we discussed in the previous episode. Yes. It's a brilliant scheme. Information we don't want them to know. Let's pretend he's sick so he doesn't have access or can't communicate at that time. Then he dies. Then the Germans send the money for the pension. And so what do? Because of the widow getting the pension and everything, they think, well, it still is a useful agent to have. It's a business. Let's bring in the widow. Then the widow becomes an agent. She's paid a pension by the Germans so they can still collect and use it. And they recruit her. And they can have her provide similar services. Because if he was a business person, I'm sure they probably said, well, now she's running the business. She's still learning the ropes, still doing information, but gives you still access.
Yes, it was a perfect way of doing things.
And they got to get some pension money.
Of course, always good.
Always good.
But the fact that they were concentrating on shipping, that eventually was one of the main information source or the main areas of concentration from their point of view of feeding in wrong information into the Germans. And they realized they need to have more people on these parts because that's what the Germans want. And that could be the big twist where they can actually feed wrong information to help out in the war.
This brings us to agent number 3. He was actually the deputy chief of all of Arabelle's network. He was the most senior agent recruited by Pujol, originally recruited while Pujol was still based in Lisbon. So he was the longest serving that survived because, of course, agent 2 died off and agent 1, the KLM guy, was never really an agent as we discussed. It was more of a useful, you know what?
Yeah.
So agent 3 was recruited on October 7th, 1941. He was Benedict Carlos, a Venezuelan student in Glasgow. His letters to the Germans were signed Pedro, so he had a code name, Pedro. He was the third and last agent recruited by Pujol in Lisbon, and he was educated in the University of Glasgow and still living in the UK at the outbreak of the war. The impression given was that he was a man of means, so from a wealthy family who had properties in Venezuela and all over. From the beginning, Pujol showed a preference for Pedro, being the oldest survivor of the network, and I think he just enjoyed writing this particular character, which sometimes happens, and it was natural that he would later gain the deputy chief of the network rank.
That means, as far as you understand, they made it clear to the Germans that Pedro actually knows everything that's going on. He was the only one that knew all the network, according to the Germans.
Yes.
So
yes.
He confided him, and Pedro, as is known, was the guy that was able to run the network if something went wrong with our guy.
Yes. So, in fact, Later, he would run the network when Pujol had to go underground for a while. He was first given secret ink to write directly to the Germans, so at a certain point, it was like he was directly writing to the Germans, but he would write in English, which the Germans were told he spoke even better than Spanish, since he had been away from Venezuela for
many
years.
And that allowed them to manage to send more information without having people to translate it. Mm-hmm. Another genius way of getting more information, instead of having before, they had to have everything written in Spanish as if it came, and he had to write it because they could see from the handwriting that it would have been different.
Right.
So the only way to do it is to have now someone else coming in to write in English and to send more information out. This way they could get double information out with more, but this time with English, it means less pressure on Pujol to do it.
His intel on the whole was of higher grade than the other agents, especially during the first 2 years of the network. Now, what's genius about this particular agent and their location as well? Glasgow, Scotland, and the UK, you know, Great Britain, London. Scots and Englishmen sometimes butt heads. So there's that aspect. And putting him as a student in a university would mean he would have contact with other youngsters and other people in different positions. There's a history of students in universities being radicalized in different ways. So access to people who maybe ideologically were sympathetic to certain causes. Eventually, Agent 3 would have three sub-agents listed under him, 3-1, 3-2, and 3-3. 3-1 was a pilot officer, an aviator, who was recruited in 1943, February 13th. So again, lead up to the D-Day landings situation. Then you also had 3-2, an officer in the British 49th Infantry Division, October 1st, 1943, and Agent 3-3, a Greek seaman and deserter, December 19th, 1943, recruited. And before that, you would assume that the information that he was getting, he was claiming was sourced from different contacts he had. And this also is a famous story in the Arabelle network where presumably Agent 3, Pedro, told Pujol that people in Glasgow will do anything for a liter of wine, which is a famous joke that they said because it showed the misunderstanding of Scottish drinking attitudes and the fact they didn't use the metric system. But that information would have come from him presumably saying, again, I can get people to tell me anything for a liter of wine.
Again, no names.
No names.
Only the name of our main guy.
Yes. Yes. So you could say that he said he had a whole sub-network of contacts and people that he was getting information from, and those three later were primary sources for deception in the ruse for the D-Day landings.
Yes.
What's interesting about Pedro, as you said moments ago, was that when Pujol was arrested, or fake arrested, because he never was really arrested, the organization would be directed, supposedly, by Pedro, who the Germans regarded as able to be a fine substitute for Pujol. Eventually, the primary goal was to run the entire organization through the MI5, as in through Pedro, without Pujol's personality being involved. Not that he himself wouldn't be involved, but that the character of Agent Alaric, Pujol's Abwehr alias. This was, in fact, achieved during the last months of the war. Pedro in direct contact with the Abwehr, utilizing MI5 officers communicating in English on wireless transmissions that were installed inside the MI5 office buildings.
Eventually, the MI5 decided that they managed to shift from Pujol to others, that they didn't really need him as someone to talk or speak or write because it wasn't necessary anymore. It was strong enough that they could actually run the whole thing without him. Now, you don't get rid of him because you might need him. But on the other hand, they had, I suppose, many, many people working on this case. It wasn't like three people in an office. There was a lot of people responsible.
Not hundreds, but
a lot of people just getting up in the morning. And all they did was think about ideas, what they're going to say, how they're going to say it, write it or send it or transmit it. And he wasn't a bottleneck anymore because they shifted from writing in Spanish on a piece of paper and sending it through a fake, you could say, and they actually had to send it through Portugal. So here they really had to find a way to get it over. And maybe sometimes it didn't make it, sometimes it was more difficult, there was weather problems, not everything arrived on time, and some of the information, they wanted them to have it on time for different reasons. So there was a whole operation just getting the information moving from now London to Portugal, to the Germans, because we don't know that he actually sent it direct. And you would think that until they moved to radio, he actually continued to use the same courier system. And it's a lot
the
of writing.
KLM pilots and the courier system.
It's a lot of writing. If you think about a guy have to write, he gets up in the morning, he has to write.
No, they would write thousands of words every day.
And he had
bunch
to write
letters,
two letters.
Different characters.
He had to write two letters, the real letter and the coded letter.
Yes.
And that's a lot of work.
It's a lot of writing.
For one person.
And keeping track of everything.
And for one person. So
well, that's
they,
why
this
it was
way
a lot
they
of
move.
People.
That's why, well, it's one person in the end who has to do it. That's him. So by moving to Pedro and his ability to use radio, it completely changed the ability of MI5 to transfer more information and then to move Puggio a little bit, not to be in the center. So he shouldn't be the bottleneck.
Yeah, just to emphasize.
Because if he was sick for a week, what'd you do?
Yeah, just to emphasize the writing aspect, because this is the same person supposedly writing the letter, okay, the actual fake story side, not the secret ink stuff, you could type theoretically, so then you wouldn't know. But the secret ink in between the lines would have to be written by the same person to match the handwriting.
Right.
Otherwise, it would be suspicious.
Exactly. So he really had to work hard. You have to make a decision what you're going to write, how much you're going to write, where is it coming from, what, how. So what we don't know, and I don't think we've mentioned it, is what when he was writing, how did he get the response from the Germans? How did he get it back? So we don't know that. So we don't know how they what kind of questions they asked him.
They would send letters to also an address in Spain, possibly the same post box, possibly a different one, whatever, and then that would be picked up by the couriers, the KLM guys, the same system.
But we don't know what the context was.
The contents of the letters?
Yes.
No, we don't know exactly what they said in different cases.
Because that would have been interesting.
In the beginning, they asked for more military information. Later, they congratulated him and told him it was great information. We cover some of what they say in the other two episodes. This brings us to Agent 4, who was a sub-chief. Every agent from this point onward was created already when he was in London with the help of MI5.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
So this guy was called Chamelius, and he was a Gibraltarian who ended up working as a waiter for the NAAFI, the Navy Army Air Force Institute, in Chislehurst in the southeast of London. He was recruited in May of 1942, so after Pujol already arrived in London. He worked in the secret military unit and was said to be manifestly anti-British because, like the rest of the civilian population, had to be evacuated from the Rock of Gibraltar due to the war. What would be his use, aside from obviously overhearing certain things, working as a waiter?
Well, first of all, his location, but it's more, it's interesting using someone from Gibraltar.
It's built-in animosity against the British.
Maybe yes, maybe no, though Gibraltar, you know, was a British colony.
Yeah,
or British,
but because he had
territory.
To be removed. So that
British
was what they were...
British territory.
Again, an ideological motive.
Yes, again, someone who speaks Spanish. That's why he made contact with him. Gibraltar, you can always... you can maybe find if it's a real person or not. That's a bit of a question mark there. But they felt strong enough that they can actually handle it because they controlled the records.
And also, he had traveled through Gibraltar... So when Pujol was brought to England, he traveled through Gibraltar.
Well,
so
the British had always control in Gibraltar.
Yeah, but I'm saying for him, maybe he also had some familiarity as a result of that he could speak to that also. Now, obviously, being a waiter in this institute provided the ability to overhear certain conversations in different ways. It was Agent 4 who brought in Agent 4-1 named Almura, who was the radio operator, the wireless transmitter, in August of 1942, so that helped with the radio transmissions. They also brought in Agent 42, a guard in Chislehurst, London department, in April 25th, 1943, and also Agent 43, a U.S., United States, non-commissioned officer who was based in London in November 5th of 1943. Now, the USNCO and maybe the guard, we don't know if they were necessarily, like the other agents, ideologically driven, or people just who happened to be friends with the other people who were willful helpers or unknowing helpers. Like, was the USNCO ideologically connected, or was he just someone who they were friends with who told them certain information that was helping them unknowingly?
I would like to look at it in a different angle. All these people that were recruited in the end for one aim, and that is to send disinformation. D-Day. Now, D-Day, when did that happen? In June, 6th of June, 44, correct? Now, when are these people recruited? A year before, or even more. So they had in mind the long game.
Misinformation was always
Misinformation is always important. But it's not like they recruited them 2 weeks before the D-Day.
No.
Or a month before the D-Day.
Well, they were also, I mean, we are so just focusing build on D-Day, up, but if you listen to the other two episodes, there are
so
more
when you build
stuff.
Up, you want when you want your agents to feel that, if you want the other side to feel that your agents are reliable, you feed the slowly, you gain the trust. So you could say that they even thought about it. Maybe they didn't know anything about the D-Day when they recruited them or invented them. But the fact that they were able to already bring people in from that part of the world who would bring that kind of information a year and a half, maybe before even the D-Day. And then when they came with information, it was regarded reliable because their past information was something they could rely upon. It wasn't like the first information they gave was about the D-Day and about the invasion. I think that was very, very clever from their point of view of building it up. Because we don't know if they didn't recruit new people just before D-Day. No, it was always reliable people that they've had before. That made it even stronger, the information.
Yeah, you have to build up trust.
Yes.
It's super, super important to build up trust. And trust is built up over time and good information. If you listen to the episodes, you'll hear about a story where they gave very, very accurate and good information that just happened to arrive too late about an operation that massively built trust
for North Africa.
In North Africa for the Arabelle network. Now, bringing in the American, I think, is interesting because now we're bringing a different flavor into the mix. An American, because the Americans had joined the war, it was important for them to have some sort of American source that could confirm certain activities from the Americans. It's important to continually branch out in the types of information that they're getting, right?
Yes, and there's another angle here that the more sources he had, the more information he brought in, the less the Germans felt they needed to recruit more. And that's another thing, a thought or thinking that they had. Let's flood them with agents. They won't have to look for something else.
In fact, according to British intelligence, the Germans considered Arabelle's network so successful and so useful that they stopped trying to recruit agents in the UK.
Yes. So that was another aim, you would say. Let's bring in information from so many places in the right places that they won't look for anyone else.
This brings us to Agent 5.
Already
codenamed Moonbeam. And I'm going to do a little dun-dun-dun-dun. Why? Because as you'll see, this guy was a bit of a cool cucumber. He was a Venezuelan who eventually would end up in Ottawa. Now, he was the brother of Agent 3, Carlos. He was recruited June 14th, 1942. Like Carlos, or Pedro, he was of independent means. Originally in Glasgow, and then later he would be employed as a commercial traveler in Canada, in Toronto, and Ottawa. We talked a little bit about this in our Agent 355, about family connections and how family ties are useful because it builds up trust and all this kind of stuff. And we see this being used here. You can create a family member and then the trust built in is already higher, right?
Yes, but there's more to this than meets the eye, in my opinion. This was a very, very interesting recruit. You could say, why introduce into the network someone that's not based in the UK? Who's someone...
Initially, he was based in the UK.
Yes, but they moved him.
Which we'll get to in a minute.
They moved him to Canada and Venezuela. Now, I know you're going to discuss it in a moment, but I will...
Preempt it.
Preempt it. And then you can go back.
And then I'll go backwards.
Exactly. Because it's very, very interesting. It's what I mentioned in the beginning. This is teasing the other side to give you information that you're giving him bait. You're saying, I have someone there. Do you want him to do anything for you? I have someone who, do you want him to check out these things for you? What do I mean? At the time, the Germans were looking at the Caribbeans and Venezuela as a place for refueling.
Yes. Right? And so they created this agent, and he was offered by the Arabelle Network to the Germans as saying, "Ooh, I have a contact who can help you refuel your submarines in the Caribbean. Do you need a refueling base? Because my parents have a property in Venezuela, so you could refuel if you want." Now, the Germans did turn down the offer, but that in and of itself was useful information, saying to them that maybe the Germans weren't planning that.
So here you, and as well, there's an Irish connection, I think, as well.
Right. He was later used as bait to draw the Germans into disclosing whether they were interested in having agents in Northern Ireland. So Moonbeam was presented as this very gusto, very athletic, daring kind of guy who really wanted to help and do it. So every time it was like, hey, we want to help, we want to help, we want to help. And so every time Arabelle could present it, we have this guy, Moonbeam, he wants to know, do you want him to go to Northern Ireland? We can send him there. And then if the Germans say, no need, then you know something. You get information.
It was a risky game, but it was worth it. If I'm looking at it from the MI5 point of view, it was a nice gamble. It was a long shot. Let's see what we can do. We can offer them someone. Let's see if they go for it or not.
Not just anyone. A person who was the brother of one of the most trusted agents already operating in the network.
Correct. So here you have another situation where you're not only feeding information, you're trying to abstract information.
Phishing.
You're phishing for information. You're seeing if the other side is interested in what you have to say, or asking you to do things for him. And the questioning of the other side comes to you, and by the questions is asked, you understand where they are and what they're thinking. So this is not just feeding information, but is getting information from the other side.
Right.
Brilliant.
And eventually he was recruited by the Germans, or they approved of a mission, when the Germans said they were interested in the Isle of Wight. And they wanted an agent there, and so they offered Moonbeam to get there. Now, at the time, it would have been difficult, if not impossible, to get there. But the Arabelle Network decided to play along and say that they would send Moonbeam there to investigate. And to make it plausible that he could enter the island, as I said, he was depicted as this really adventurous risk-taker who was prepared to do anything for the Germans. And so they started explaining in great detail to the Germans how he conducted this like crazy adventurous operation in order to get into the Isle of Wight with this perilous experience. It was like a spy novel. But the Germans believed it. And Agent 5 rose in their estimation, having completed the dangerous mission. Later, he would tour the south coast of England and Wales, you know, a restless character. He always wanted change. And then with the help later of Agent 7, who we'll discuss, he was smuggled out of England to Canada with instructions from Pujol and presumably the Obver to set up a sub-organization there, which he did. All of this completely fake, of course. And by August of 1943, he was already communicating in secret from Canada, writing to a cover address in Lisbon provided by the Germans for that exact purpose.
As I said, brilliant, very clever. This is people thinking outside the box of what we can do, how we can feed information, but not only feed information, but get information and get intelligence from the other side without them realizing that they're actually giving this information out.
I mean, I would love to know what this story is about him sneaking into the Isle of Wight. That's like some spy novel that they invented this whole fictitious thing. I mean, it would be crazy because they have all the information on the Isle of Wight and then they have to invent a way that a person would have infiltrated. I mean, just, it's great. It's hilarious. It's great.
I think they had fun doing it.
I'm sure they had fun. And
but it was serious stuff.
As far as the Germans were concerned, wow, this guy, crazy, yes. James Bond agent.
That's
type
why
of
the agents
person.
Were, the network was amazing network from that point of view.
Yeah, and then of course, send him to Canada. We haven't had success there, or we want better success. Send him there, set up an organization there. Great. And then we have Agent 5-1, who was a cousin of Moonbeam and Benedict, who was operating in Buffalo, New York, as of October of 1943. So again, keep it in the family. You already have two really successful agents in that family that the Germans like. Let's bring in another one in New York. Why not? In a place people in America. Get some info there. So we don't have a lot of information about that particular agent, the cousin, but another source of information.
It's interesting. I'm thinking to myself, did the MI5 convey some of this information of what they were doing to the Americans?
I mean, they share intelligence.
And there may be, we're not sure about this stage how much they shared of what they're doing with him. But maybe it was a way where the Americans said, well, we want to know what they're up to in America. So maybe the MI5 decided, you know what, let's introduce an American link or connection and see where it leads us. I think that's as well where it comes from.
Possibly, yeah. Good phishing device like they did before with phishing. Yeah, for sure. Agent 6, very, very lengthy bit of information on Agent 6. He was a field security NCO, and he was killed in 1943. That's it. That's what we have. So I actually think this is really interesting, though, because if I was going about this, I could have like written this letter to the Abwehr at a certain point, like, oh my God, found this amazing contact. He's brilliant. He's going to be an amazing asset for us. He's the best. He's the greatest. And maybe send like one letter from him and then immediately kill them.
You build up the confidence. You build up the reliability.
Reliability, yeah. Like realism on this. Like, he's great. He's so good. It's amazing. The Germans, and he's dead. It's like, ah, damn, so close. Brilliant. I mean, I don't know if that's how he was dealt with at the time, but we don't have a lot of information on him at all, and we do know that he was killed, so I'm just spitballing, but it could be. Could be.
When you have the other side eating everything you feed them.
Waiting desperately.
Yes, and everything is not questioned. Even if they try and question it, because we don't know if, we haven't have any evidence that they tried even to question anything, you can really play around with it.
This brings us to Agent 7. Codenamed Dagobert, because I don't believe that would be his real name, but maybe it is. Dagobert. He was an ex-seaman in Swansea, Wales. That's all we have for him. But what is interesting is all of the subdivisions that he brings to us. So we have 7-1, very, very important character. This is a British soldier in the 9th Armored Division who was recruited in September 16th, 1943. The 9th Armor Division was frequently referred to in messages as the Panda Division because its insignia was a panda, and it was built up as the first line formation by Erebo at the time for Operation Starkey, which was the deception operation for D-Day, pretending that it was going to invade Calais. The Germans took a really big interest in this division. Maybe it was because of the association of words of panda and panzer, that's one thought, seemed to register for them, and they eventually would accept this division was likely part of the assault for the second front that would be opened in Calais. So this was a soldier in that division who was presumably giving information such as, the troops were issued embarkation kits and vomit bags and they're assembling and all signs here are showing that we're about to leave for France. This whole buildup for the potential invasion of the 9th Armored Division until eventually this was allowed to fade out since the plans were revealed that it wasn't amongst the divisions to be used in the battle eventually.
So it comes back to what I'm thinking that I said earlier. When you're looking at it from the MI5 point of view, and I'm looking at both sides, I'm saying to myself, we know this unit is going to be part of the invasion or the what we have in mind. We don't want the Germans really to look for someone there. So let's bring someone so they won't have to look for someone. And if we have someone there reporting, they won't have to recruit anyone. So that keeps them one step back from what the reality is. Then the moment the unit is not supposed to be really involved, then they fade him away. It's all part of one, feeding information, and second, making sure they don't really go out and find the real information.
Right. We have now 6 sub-agents, 7-2, 7-3, 7-4, 7-5, 7-6, and 7-7. Not much about any of these particular people, but we have 7-2, Donnie, who was the leader of the World Aryan Order, an ex-seaman, recruited December 6th, 1943. We can see why he might be recruited, being as the leader of the World Aryan Order. Then we have 7-3, codenamed W-R-E-N, Wren, in London, February 1944. Then we have 7-4, Dick, an Indian fanatic, February 1944, also recruited, presumably ideologically driven as well, maybe because he was against the British at the time, who knows. 7-5, Drake, a relative of 7-2. That would be Donnie, the World Aryan Order leader. He was in Exeter, UK, February of 1944. That's a lot of February recruits. 7-6, a Welshman in South Wales, February 1944. 7-7, Doric, another Welshman in England, February of 1944. Which leads me to believe that all of the February recruits were potentially linked, with the exception of the Indian fanatic, because that wouldn't necessarily make sense with the World Aryan Order. And so they would presumably be part of the World Aryan Order as well, maybe as a connection of just different people who were supplying information. All of this in the build-up, maybe to the D-Day operations.
I would think that he got a message from the Germans saying, we need more information about what's going on. And you have to recruit people from certain areas because maybe they'll have more information.
Mm.
And that's why he went out and decided, okay, let's get some new guys in because it's going to be a new invasion, a bigger invasion, more forces. And so he says, okay, this is, and then he decides, okay, they decide, because it wasn't him by himself, let's find some people, feed them with more information because that makes sense to the different kind of information we want. So we'll feed them a little bit more here, because by February, I think already they had in mind that they want to do something and the forces were starting to build up. So you would say that the MI5 decided, okay, we need more people in different various areas to build up our story. And these people were recruited already specifically, I think, for the D-Day.
Yeah, 4 months before D-Day. It makes sense the Germans would say, hey, we fear there's an invasion. We need more information. Get as much as you can. So then you'd create these other agents to trickle information. These would not be big hitting agents, but just different people who
and
would trickle
nicknames,
information.
And their nicknames, not real names.
Yeah, of course. Just to go back for a second, Agent 7 was the person who helped smuggle Agent 5 out to Canada.
It makes it all personal. Yeah.
So all of that. And that is the extent of the specific people that we know that are listed in the different bits about the Arabelle Network, an extensive network spread across the UK and other places, people in key positions. Fascinating, no?
Yes, I would say, thinking about it, that if I had to play the game of MI5, I would make one of my staff be each one of these players and ask him to be that guy. What kind of information would he bring to the table? And what kind of information is he volunteered? And then play them with each other and see what happens.
Yeah, role-playing, war-gaming.
Yes. And so you had at least, maybe some can play two or three roles. Maybe.
Smaller roles, maybe, but yeah. But certainly the bigger ones.
Because then you have, he knows exactly what he said or didn't say. Even Thomas decided to keep a diary of everything. Even that, just keeping a diary of everything, that takes time.
And
his time is not supposed to be spent just on that.
Right.
He's supposed to be looking at the big picture. And looking at the big picture, there was a big picture here. There was a lot of people, a lot of information, a lot of technology in those days, a lot of broadcasting. We're not looking as well as I asked you before, and we mentioned it, but we didn't talk about it because there's nothing to talk about in this aspect of what did the Germans respond each time, because you have to respond to the Germans. You have to react to what you hear and understand what they're trying to check and what they're trying to understand, what kind of information they're looking for, and where can we give information without giving information. So every day was like, okay, what's new? What can we do today? One person can't do it, obviously. And what else it tells us, that there was no leaks. So from the MI5 point of view, it's not only doing it, it's making sure that nothing leaks. Because if it leaks, it's a big success for the other side and the whole thing falls out. And I think at a certain point, it became so big and so heavy, they had to move Puget out because it was too much for one person to have on his back. Even though he was working together, they decided, you know what? Now that we have things running without you, let's put you in a way where you are not in the main frame. I was surprised that they actually decided to arrest him, because if they arrest him or they put him, then he'll be questioned and things might change. Why would they do that? I don't know. We don't know why the reasoning for that.
So Pujol's arrest, I couldn't find a lot of information about it, but I mean, it could have been something as trivial as like you got drunk one pub evening, and so it could be that, or it could be something like you were suspected of. But if they arrested him for suspicion of whatever,
of espionage, that wasn't good.
That's not a good thing to be arrested for.
You don't need to do it unless there was something that maybe the Germans said, maybe put your profile down a little bit.
Right.
Maybe ask someone else. So maybe they responded to something the Germans said. We don't know.
Right.
But what we do know,
I mean, one of the reasons
nothing was leaked. Well, so one of the Germans were not able to find out that this was going on.
Well, one of the reasons Pujol wanted to be arrested as well was because he himself didn't want to give information on a certain topic that the Germans asked him about. Listen to the episode to find out what. But it's also part of that. So similar to what happened with, you know, Agent 2 of being sick and then dying, well, he couldn't get sick and then die himself because he didn't want to, but he could get himself arrested.
I mean, I know
we're
towards the end of this this podcast of this area, but it's interesting they decided to move to Venezuela, that how Venezuela was so interesting in his biography.
Yes, Pujol eventually would live in Venezuela the rest of his days in a little twist ending that he himself created for himself also. Yes. Eventually, Pujol would be awarded the Iron Cross by the Germans and an MBE by the British, so awarded from both sides for his services. The Germans were none the wiser about any of the fictitious nature of his organization up until the end of the war. Still didn't know. Up until much later, they still didn't know. Incredibly successful network, unbelievably vast. What would you have done differently, if anything, or what would you have added?
In today's world, it would have been very difficult to invent people and the people, the other side will not.
Well, you can Facebook them and see if they're real, right? It's easier
today. It's much easier, and it would have been much more difficult to invent so many people. And if the other side had any suspicions about them, to look into it. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, just the couriers from the airline, that would be something you would check. It's too vulnerable to leave it by chance. The mail coming in and out, you would always have like a red team who would check and say, okay, is it real or not real? And then they'll start checking. So there's a lot of things that today's world would be more difficult, but in those days, brilliant operation. And the guy was a genius to actually pull it off.
And as we saw, there was working together of the different agents as well. So, you know, that was useful to also create those inter-network relations and communications to strengthen the network itself as if it was its own living, breathing organism. The family ties was also useful, or the spousal ties, or in the case of the World Aryan Order, different connections there. So we've seen that also with Agent 355, how the Culper Ring was different family connections initially, also in different levels, because you can trust certain people that you grew up with
and
in different areas.
When you look at the double agent, and when you look at it from an intelligence point of view, it gives you an insight of what the other side is thinking and what it needs and what he has. And I think not only were they able to send false information in, but get information from the network to be useful for the British intelligence and for the networks that they were doing, and make sure that the Germans were not recruiting new people, and that they don't have people in your networks, in your system, that could actually tell you that you've been compromised. So it was a really big success.
If today someone was setting out to create a network, fictitious or real, what would be an initial step? Where would someone begin? Or is that too broad of a question? How does one go about building a network of contacts?
It's too of a wide question. But
what are
in
some
general,
ways? Familial connections are useful?
Look, networks are more vulnerable. They don't usually last. You would prefer to have one-on-one because the chances of it being a longer range surviving is okay. If you want to do something, you need a team, then you have no choice. One person can't do it. So you have to build a network. But it can last for one mission, two missions, depend where it is. It depends what kind of thing you're doing. One thing is sending people in as a network. The other thing is, remember, the network in this case was domestic. That means it was people in your territory. Running a network not in your territory, like the resistance, one falls, other can fall. So you have to be very careful how you do it. In a time of war, it's even more dangerous. So it depends. It's, as I said, it's a big question with different answers that I can give you. It depends on the enemy, the target, and what you want to achieve.
But the risk is great, obviously, in networks. And I would say, as we've seen with Arabelle Network, rightfully so, most of the people connected to the network, even though it's fictitious, were driven by ideology to be a part of it. And so ideology, as we've already explored throughout the show, is a much stronger glue for people acting in certain ways than blackmail, money, other things. So that would be what would keep together a network much stronger as well.
Well, that's how the Russians managed to recruit so many good agents in England.
Ideology, yeah. So one could say, when setting out a network, make sure that you seek ideologically aligned people rather than people who are in it for other reasons, right? That would be one.
No, sometimes your best agents work for money and sometimes...
But for ideology. The length of and health of, no?
Networks are networks. And if there's a weak link in one of the networks from ideology, it could change and you can bring the whole thing down.
If an agent works for money and they're a great agent, someone else offers them more money, they're not tied by ideology. They'll go to the other agent, the other person.
You have to make sure he doesn't get offered that money.
Whereas if you're driven by ideology, someone can't offer you a counter ideology.
Yes, but if someone catches you and then says to you, we will go against your family, then let's question his ideology.
Sure, but if you're ideologically driven, you're much more likely to stand up to that than if you're monetarily driven.
Again, depends on what prison you're
that's
held.
True too, but one could theoretically assume...
Look, it's one thing when you're working in your own country and one thing when you're working inside an enemy country. In this case, we're looking at people working in your own country and it was a fake network. Having a real network is a different case. Imagine the case officer running 20 people and the case officer gets caught. He can... The whole case falls out.
Right.
So... It's the same thing. It's a very big, it's an art. Running a network is an art.
Compartmentalizing, I think, would be important then.
It's so many things to do with it in today's world as well. From how you handle it, kind of communications, where do you meet? It is the same communications, same kind of meetings, same kind of places. There's so many things to do with it. And if someone falls, does everything fall? How do you build it? It doesn't happen. It's a lot of work. For any agency to do it. Networks are not a preferable, I would say, way to run agents. Only if it's very, very specific for specific jobs.
Certainly not pyramid-type networks, right? You don't want a network where it's built like a pyramid. You want to have things more like columns that are not
connected.
Yes,
but even if a pyramid and one guy runs them and he falls, then...
Well, that's what I'm saying.
No, you're not looking at one guy running them and he falls and doesn't make any how the pyramid is built, it all falls. So it's in the pyramid, if one guy knows everything and you get to him, he knows everything, everything falls. Networks are not something you really want to have, okay? It's sometimes you have to, sometimes you have, as we talked about, having the wives join. What does it do for the network, even in this case?
Find out on episode 1 and 2.
Right, and this episode as well. What do they have to do to keep the wife quiet? And that was just 2 people. And now imagine you have real networks with real people, with real wives and real spouses. It's not easy.
Any tips for running a network then?
Don't.
Anything else you want to say?
No. Not at the moment.
Not at the moment, okay. We hope you enjoyed this change of pace episode. And we will end, as we always do, with a little dramatization. This one coming from our old friend, Sun Tzu, and the art of war, his art of spying.
This time you're really quoting, or is it just a...
This is a real quote, I promise.
Thank you.
All warfare is based on deception. Hence, when we are able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must appear inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away. When far away, we must make him believe we are near. All warfare is based on deception. This was Spies and Lies. Thanks for listening. And remember,
don't use networks if you don't have to, but if you do, this was a good example of how to do it.
Spies and Lies is a Grumpy Golem production, with original scoring and mastering by Julian Dussault. If you enjoyed listening, don't forget to share with your friends and leave a comment or review wherever you listen from. It really does help. So if you listen from Apple and feel so inclined, leave us a review. If you have any questions or subjects you'd like for my father and I to cover, drop us a message, and we'll do our best to get back to you. Until next time.